chance of introducing Michael, our speaker for this evening.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Michael, and I'm a compulsive overeater. And I want to thank John, who is probably getting ready to go see Wicked tonight. He scored some good tickets. I saw him at a meeting this morning, and I said, you got to give him a way to keep him. I'll take the tickets if you want, but he didn't go for it. And but I am glad to be here. We have somebody visiting, I guess, from San Francisco. Is it Jenna?
Yes.
Jenna, I remember. I talked to her a little bit, and I tried to crack a joke. I said, I heard the main speaker is kind of mediocre, but I'm here to support him. So here I am, here to support myself, but you guys are really supporting me. I came to you originally in the early 80s. I got sober originally, clean and sober, in 1982, and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a three-pack-a-day cigarette addiction, and I didn't know what to do, and towards the end of my year, I was really, really miserable, and I started bitching and pitching about it in AA meetings, and old-timers got upset, and they came up to me, and they said, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Shut up. And I felt very rejected because up until that point, I was going to meetings where you could say basically whatever you wanted to. You didn't have to make sense at all. And I wasn't getting too much recovery, but I was staying sober. And so somebody was nice enough to come up to me after one of those meetings and told me that there was something called Smokers Anonymous. And I think now it's called Nicotine Anonymous. They're still around. And I went to one of these meetings in Hollywood, and there was like one person there. And he talked to me for an hour about what he was like, what happened, what he's like now without cigarettes. And he said, I'll see you next week. and I came back. And I, in retrospect, it took about 6 weeks of me coming back. And the three-pack-a-day obsession was removed. And it was terrific. And shortly after, he nominated me secretary of the meeting. And many weeks I would show up by myself with a big book, but I had stopped smoking. Now, the thing is that I put on 30 pounds in 30 days, real quickly, and I had compulsively overate before, but I wasn't really aware of it until I got sober and until I stopped smoking. And so I went back to AA, and I started bitching about Haagen-Dazs and pizza and I mean, all the stuff that I was overeating, and I probably the same old timers came up to me and, you know, told me to shut up, you know. But I was wise because I knew there was Overeaters Anonymous. So I came to you guys, and I don't think I identified right away as a compulsive overeater, but I listened, and I heard that most of you, you know, ate three meals a day and nothing in between, and a lot of you didn't eat sugar, and a lot of you didn't eat white flour or whatever. So I thought, you know, intellectually I got the program. But I didn't, and I fussed around for about a year, and I just kept getting bigger and bigger, and finally I raised my hand at a meeting, and I said, my name is Michael, and I'm a compulsive overeater, and I don't know how to do this. I need help. And whenever I do that in program, inevitably I get help, but it's hard to ask for help. Not so much now anymore, but it was back then. And so Matt M., who was a 100-pounder, he lost way over 100 pounds, gave me his number and told me to call him. And I called him, and he asked me what I had eaten the day before, and I had no idea. And he asked me what I was going to eat that day, and I had no idea, and I didn't want to have any idea. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. And I was in la-la land because I was using food to anesthetize myself. And I didn't, and I guess I must have had the willingness to want to stop because I trusted Matt. And he got me familiar with taking a fifth step with my food. And if you're relatively new, a fifth step is admitted to God, to ourselves and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Well, for me, it's the exact nature of my food as well. And I started doing that consistently, and the weight started to come off. And I don't even know if I got Matt as a sponsor. I don't remember. But I do remember around the five-year mark, I started getting complacent in both of my programs. And I stopped going to meetings on a consistent basis. I don't think I had any commitments. I don't even remember if I had a sponsor in OA. I had one in AA, but I wasn't calling him consistently. And I started getting involved in outside issues. And outside issues, I think, in retrospect, are fine, because I hear many, many people in therapy and in program that are flourishing. For me, I decided to substitute program for therapy. And I got crazy. And I started getting real introspective. And I started blaming a lot of people who were dead and who were alive and feeling my feelings and analyzing. And I couldn't understand, because program was telling me to get out of myself and shake the hands of the newcomer and forget about myself. And therapy was telling me to get into myself. And I guess I chose to get into myself. And I was so into myself that by about 7 years with you guys, I lost my abstinence. And for me, you know, because I'm also an alcoholic, I mean, if I drink or I use pills alcoholically, then I break my abstinence. And I'm glad that I'm clear on that, that the two are so enmeshed. So in this building, I came to a meeting and I heard Dr. Paul speak. And Dr. Paul is in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think now the story is called On Acceptance. In those days it was Dr. Addict Alcoholic. And he said a couple of things that changed my life, but the main thing he said, and at the time, ladies and gentlemen, I was seeing three psychiatrists. I was on a prescription to some antidepressant, and I had quit my job that I had been working for 12 and a half years with a pretty reputable company. Not full-time job, by the way, because I didn't want to commit full-time. In those days, I considered myself an actor, and I needed to take off at noon so that I could go to the beach and work on my tan in case any auditions came up. And there may have been auditions, but I wasn't really pursuing them very well. I liked the beach. The beach was kind of nice. And so anyway, you know, I got to tell you, to this day, I mean, this is my 13th year. Thank God that I've got a pretty reputable job and I show up on a consistent basis. And I don't like to work, to tell you the truth. I never had a full-time job until I was 43 years old. And that's one of the things that says, you know, your past, you can be embarrassed of it, but you can kind of be proud of it in a way, because I'm proud of the 13 years that the program has taught me to show up on a consistent basis, whether I want to or not. And it's been good. So anyway, Dr. Paul said, this was around 1990, because my abstinence date is July 20th, 1990. He said, in all my 20-some-odd years of sobriety, he was 20-something then, have I had a problem to which the 12 steps did not offer me a solution? And to me, I was so far removed from the 12 steps, and I was so into introspection, and three psychiatrists, and you know, unable to pay the rent, unwilling to pay the rent, scared to death, resentful. I was in active, compulsive overeatingism, if you want to call it. In my other program, I call it alcoholism. I didn't care what I was eating in those days. So I was too afraid to ask him for his phone number after the meeting, but his wife, Max, was sitting in the front row, and I went up to her, and I asked for the phone number. And I called him, and I told him what had happened to me. And he suggested that I come back to the program that had saved my life originally. And he said, what you're doing right now doesn't appear to be working, Michael. And I trusted him. And so I started to call him on a consistent basis. And I started to get involved. I wanted to get a home group, because I never had a home group before. and I suggested a pretty strong and structured, disciplined home group in AA, which I had resisted for many, many years in my first sobriety, and he said that he thought it would be a good idea. And I got involved in that home group, and I got a strong sponsor. And after getting sober for a bit, I must have been aware of my compulsive overeating. And I remember going to my AA sponsor and telling him, I can't stop. And I was involved in OA before. And I was afraid that my sponsor, because we believe in only having one sponsor, my old MO was to get several sponsors and run my ideas by all of them until the one that I could get to agree with me would say okay, and then I'd be running the show myself. So anyway, I told him, and he said, try every diet you can, and if it doesn't work, you go back to OA, that's fine. And I didn't take his direction that time. I said, you know what, I think I want to go back to OA. And he said, well, go ahead. He said, but I have to get a sponsor. And he said, go ahead. And I did. And it was such a relief that I had permission to do that. And at the time, I had called Dr. Paul once, and he got really angry at me. And he said, you know, Mike, there's a part of you that wants to recover, and there's a part of you that doesn't want to recover. And I'm going to leave you alone with yourself for a little while. Don't call me for a while. And it was awful. And in a way, it was wonderful, because I was left alone with the choice of recovery or disease one more time. And I knew Richie, who, if you were at the Thanksgiving meeting, he was the main speaker there from my previous experience in OA. And I went to Richie and I said, geez, Richie, I've just finished this fourth step, and, you know, I got people in AA that I wanted to listen to, and some people are telling me to condense it because it's too long. Dr. Paul won't listen to it because he says he judges me, and he thinks it should be a spiritual experience, and it won't be spiritual because he judges me and it's his character. I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, Michael, he said, somebody listened for 3 days to my fifth step. Come on over and I'll listen to you. And sure enough, on the third day, we were both nauseous because it was the same stuff over and over, and the same character defects, different situations. But Richie listened and became my OA sponsor, and I started taking a fifth step on a daily basis with him as to what the exact nature of my food was, and if I'd eat stuff like I don't know, a cheeseburger or something, and he'd go, cheese, he'd go, that's an artery blocker. Artery blocker. What are you doing eating cheese for? And so, you know, I'd be conscious that cheese is an artery blocker, and so the next day I would abstain from cheese. But the main thing was is that I was honest with him, you know, and which was so hard for me in the beginning. And now it's on a daily basis, it's relatively easier. My abstinence date coincides, corresponds with my sobriety date. It's July 20th, 1990. And my sponsor today, Terrell, has heard the exact nature of my food. The only reason I don't have Richie anymore is because he decided to desert me and get married, and he moved to Nashville or New York, you know, a few years ago, and I wouldn't let go. I don't know, there's people that get a lot of sponsors in this program, but I'm like a creature of habit, and it's hard for me to trust, you know, and once I trust somebody, you know, I hang on for dear life. And I was calling Rich for a while, and, you know, Rich said, you know, I'm in New York, it's good if you see the sponsor that you sponsor. And so anyway, I let him go, and I started asking around for sponsorship here in L.A., and I've been with Terrell for years now, and thank God that relationship is in good stead, and God forbid it should be severed for some reason, and I'd have to go out and find another sponsor. I've worked this program on my own. I have experience, and I don't want to have that experience anymore. It's really, really painful, and ultimately it causes me to go out and practice my disease. I told you that I didn't get a job until I was 43 years old, a full-time job. I was in my sponsor's office one day, and I told you I considered myself an actor, and I was working part-time, and I And I made the mistake of telling him that before I came to you guys back in the 80s, I went to school to become a teacher. And I took all kinds of methods classes. And in the middle of that, right when I was in the middle of student teaching, I quit. And again, in retrospect, through inventories, I quit so that I could practice my disease. I found a lady who would support me and take care of me, and I didn't have to work full time. And I could practice my disease, and we could live happily ever after in our mishigas and our craziness. So here I am, like 17 years later, in my sponsor's office, that's sort of talking about that. And he said, well, why don't you go back and see what it would take to get your teaching credential? And I said, well, I don't think I want to teach. You know, I think I want to act. And he said, well, you know what, Mike, it doesn't matter if you want to act or teach or whatever you want to do. It's just the spiritual concept here is going back and completing something that you left incomplete. And he said, can you go back and talk to a counselor? And that I could do, you know, just that one step. And so I went back and talked to a counselor. And it turns out that all my methods classes that I had taken 17 years prior were applicable to 17 years ahead. And I had a little bit of work to do. And I told you I don't like to work. So, and I still didn't want to do the work. And my sponsor said, well, just do the next indicated step. And I think I had to take one class, and then I was student teaching, like within a few months or something. And I had quit the three part-time jobs I was working so that I could concentrate on student teaching and really, like, become a teacher, I guess. And in this class that I was doing my student teaching at, they would volunteer for an hour a week in a special ed class, in a classroom full of little kids with walkers and wheelchairs and cerebral palsy. These kids, you know, my heart melted when I came and I worked with them. And I loved them right away. And I guess the teacher in that classroom saw that I had an affinity for these kids. And she introduced me to someone. And when I went out on my job interviews, and I was scared to death to go to interviews. I mean, I don't have any teaching experience. Any interview, I'm just fear-based. So I remember I took my student teaching, the kids wrote me letters. We love you, Mr. Block. You're the best teacher we ever had and all this stuff. And I took that as part of my resume. And I was just honest. I said, you know, this is all I have. I'm just starting out. I'm middle-aged, 43 years old. But if this is any indication of, you know, my passion for them. And sure enough, out of the three interviews I went on, two of the three offered me a job. And the one that I was the most interested in was a special ed class. The kids were physically health impaired. And the principal said, we would welcome you into our school, but you have to go back to school and get a degree in special education. And I went to my sponsor. And he says, well, he said, it sounds like that's where your passion is. And I went, and I got that classroom. And one class at a time. For 10 weeks, I'd go to Cal State LA for 4 hours a week, and eventually it took me years and years to get my special ed credential. But I was teaching at the time, and I was doing what they were teaching me, which was quite a concept. You know, normally my compulsive overeating brain, this is all theory, it's bullshit, which I still said, you know, because I was actually in the trenches working with these kids, but I felt a part of a program. And I would come to you. I got myself a commitment on Saturday morning at the kitchen sink. You know, whatever they needed me to do, I'd be there because most Saturday mornings I want to sleep in. And if I have a commitment, I don't sleep in. Or if I'm going to not be there, I call my sponsor and I say, you know what, my daughter has a dance recital or whatever the excuse is. I'm going to get somebody to cover my commitment. Is it okay? I check it out with my sponsor because I think I have a healthy fear of this disease and running the show myself. And for today. So anyway, where was I going with that? I forgot. Special ed credential. I got the credential. And I got the job. And the lady that I was living with could not support me in the manner to which I was accustomed when I first came to you guys again. And so we both became self-supporting through our own contributions. And shortly after I became abstinent, fertility set in. And Christine and I had three children. And those children, and Nikki is now 8. And Ileana is 11 and Isabella is 15. So, and we got married and committed, you know. And it's just amazing. I thought that when I left hell, I have a 30-year-old son who I was telling Francine is, if he keeps doing what he's doing, he's going to celebrate a year's sobriety coming up in January. That's a whole other story, but that's from my previous marriage. And I thought that by leaving my previous marriage that all the troubles would be left over there. But I have to tell you, those of you who are pursuing relationships, you know, we take ourselves with us wherever we go. And all that stuff that I dealt with Helen and my stuff, because program teaches me to look at my stuff, I had to deal with Christine. You know, it's the same stuff. But, you know, you guys taught me how to communication. Dr. Paul used to talk a lot about communication. And, God, I don't know about you guys, but Christine and I years ago would fight over money a lot, you know, because we're scared. I was scared. And, you know, we try on a consistent basis to sit down, you know, used to be once a week, now it's like every other week. And before we talk, you know, grab her hand and we tell each other we love each other, whether we mean it or not, just to start out and say a little prayer, whatever comes to mind. God, please let me know that Christine is not the enemy and that we're on the same page and we both love our kids or whatever comes to mind. And that softens my heart a lot. I mean, I used to be where Christine works in the cafeteria and I'm throwing pencils. I mean, I was nuts. And we've come a long, long way. And on my good days, it's kind of weird because, you know, we've been together, well, we've been married for 16 years and we were 10 years prior. We've been here 26 years. It's unbelievable. And on my good days, it's weird. I love her more today than I did in the beginning. Our relationship wasn't formed in recovery, that's for sure. But it is today, and that feels good. God, what is it? 6:20 I speak till? I may open it up, but let me just think a little bit more. Christine, my wife, has worked for the LA Times for 33 years. And they told her a few months ago that they were not downsizing, but where they hire people in Puerto Rico to do her job. And they're going to do that. So in June, she's going to be 33 years at the time. She's going to be let go. And they're offering her like a year severance package. And, you know, she has retirement there. But it's going to change our lives a bit. I'm a teacher. And one of the perks of teaching is you're off in the summer. And I love that. You know, I used to work pretty through the summer, but now I have kids, and I use the excuse that I want to be with them on summer vacation, which is true most of the time, but sometimes I don't. Kids can get annoying, especially when you teach kids all day. So we're going to, you know, no earthquakes and the river stays healthy, whatever that means, we're going to spend the summer together. And so it's a little bit of a change. 11 years into teaching special ed, I started to get really, really burned out. And with the No Child Left Behind, they were coming down. You know, I don't know, teachers, if there are any in the room, I love you a lot. There's a lot of pressure on us right now. And for special ed, if I had I had a K-3 combination class, 4 different grade levels trying to teach these babies, and if the kid was nonverbal, they expected him, a third grader, to test on the third grade level. And I said, that's crazy. That's right. Well, you know, you got to do it and do the best you can. And, you know, I love the parents and I love the kids, but I was just, because I'm a perfectionist, and I couldn't do what I expected, my head told me to do. And so a job came along in LA Unified through a series of sort of God shots coincidence to go and teach kids in LA Unified theater arts. And which is, you know, I always thought I was, you know, wanted to be an actor and stuff. So I'm going during the year to 7 different schools, 3 at a time, 3 every 4 months. And I'm teaching kids improvisation and pantomime and communication. And I think really what I'm trying to do is to, I mean, if they felt like I did as a kid, I'm just trying to let them know that they're okay. And I love special ed because I still teach a few special ed classes as well. So it's a dream job, but I still don't want to do my friggin' lesson plans, you know. I do them anyway, and I show up. I told Christine, I said, you know, it's 2 weeks until Christmas vacation. We get 3 weeks off for Christmas. And I thought, you know, they expect me to show up every day for the next 2 weeks. Is that fair? It's just ridiculous. And she just kind of rolls her eyes and says, you know, go to a meeting, Michael. You'll be fine. What else can I tell you? Isabella's in junior high school, 15 years old. You guys taught me that to be overprotective is not a good thing. And yet I want to be a good parent. And I don't want to give the message that the world... I don't want to give the message of fear to Issa. And I come from a place of fear. And in order to give that to a higher power, I come to you. And I do what I'm doing tonight. And so Issa knows me pretty well. And she knows that I just love her to death. And I just pray a lot that I can be the best... I really want to be the best parent that I can be. And many times I fall short, and I get scared. So far today, she's okay. I got so pissed off at one of my friends. We go to yogurt after a meeting on Friday night. I see some of you there also. It's nice they have sugar-free yogurt there. Anyway, last night I was there, and my friend said, well, Christine's not... you know, into the disease. She's not a compulsive overeater. She's not an alcoholic. And my friend said, well, that doesn't matter. You know, it could be hereditary. And, you know, I just wanted to punch him out, you know, because for today, you know, none of my kids are practicing the disease. And just a little side note, in my family, it seems like it's a little genetic things going on. My mom was diagnosed with postpartum depression after she had me, and a lot of ladies are diagnosed. But she never got better, and in the early 50s, they diagnosed her finally as schizophrenic. And she came home with a lot of suicide attempts and stuff, and she loved shock treatment because she said it was the only thing that shocked her back into reality, temporarily. And there was an operation called a lobotomy around in those days, and she begged to have it done. She was not a happy person. And she had the lobotomy, and it didn't make her any worse, but it didn't make her any better either. And she ended up in her early 40s at Camarillo State Hospital going to get a pack of cigarettes and keeling over from a heart attack. And, I used to think that that was pretty cruel, you know, of God to do that. And, but... if she was like catatonic and suicidal and everything, can you imagine what another 43 years would be like living that kind of life? So, you know, program and my higher power teaches me that, you know, I believe she's at peace now with God. And the purpose of her life, my dad asked at the funeral, and the rabbi said, sometimes we don't know, you know. And I thought, what a lame answer. You know? Even a rabbi doesn't know, you know. But... I'm abstinent, you know, 17 years, I've got a full, rich life. Without my mom, I wouldn't be here. My son is coming up on, you know, a year clean and sober. If it is genetic and my 3 other kids, you know, we're here, thank God the fellowship, the program is here, and there's God for me is here. So, and then my dad died of cirrhosis of the liver, you know, in his late 50s and stuff, and his dad died of cirrhosis of the liver. So I don't say that because, you know, if you had my problems, you would eat as well. And not to show that it's genetic, but to be grateful that my family, who was bouncing off the walls, I could tell you all kinds of stories. And I am going to open it up a little bit because I like to hear you guys. I'm getting dry. I want to get some water. But bouncing all over the walls here from the disease. And today, myself and thank God my son, we left that behind, and it's not here anymore. So for me, the answer is here, and the miracle is here. And even if you are afraid and you've got the genetic proclivity in your family, you know, to have the disease that we have here, the answer is here, or at least it has been for me. And I just hope that if you stick around, if you're new, you find what I found. And I hope that I continue to keep doing what I'm doing. And I appreciate you all for listening. Thank you.
Do you want to do questions, Michael, or no?
Yeah.
And if there are no questions, I'll open it up for you. Yes.
Thank you very much, Michael. I was wondering if you talk a little bit about how you work steps 10 and 11.
Okay, let's continue to take personal inventory and sought through prayer and meditation. I've got this, you know, you guys taught me, you know, my AA sponsor in the big book, it says, you know, when we retire at night, were we selfish, dishonest, resentful, are we holding any secrets? And I went to my AA sponsor and he said, shit, you know, you can answer yes to every one of those, kid. He said, you know, you don't want to get more self-obsessed than you are. He says, you know, don't do that. And then Richie taught me the AEIOU. And the AEIOU is a simple inventory. And I took it to my AA sponsor as well. I said, you know, I'm doing this inventory. And I explained it to him. He said, all right. So AEIOU is A, you know, taking a fifth step with my food is my abstinence. What has my food been like? Coming clean with that. E is, am I getting any exercise? Have I done any exercise? And I is something that I've done for myself, and a big I for me today is right here, right now. This is the best thing that I can possibly do. And O is something that I've done for others. And then after I mentioned the O for a while, my sponsor said, you know, Michael, there's a spiritual principle that when you do something for someone else and don't get found out, it's more spiritual. So now my O is to be kept between me and my higher power, unless there are some days that I said, well, Jesus, did I do anything for somebody else? And I'll tell my sponsor the next day, I didn't have anything. I got to concentrate on helping others today. For me, it used to be uncovering feelings until I just like wrote everything that was down in my head, and my sponsor said, you know, could you simplify? You know, let's keep it simple. The you for now, for me, I don't know about you guys, and this is sort of embarrassing. I've got a clutter problem. I live with three kids and I live with a wife, and I, you know, when I come home I just put things, you know, I don't find places to put things, and I'm not real organized, which is hard when you're a teacher. So I am better now than I used to be, but you is uncluttering. Have I done any uncluttering in the house? Have I taken some shirts that I haven't worn in 10 years and given them away? Have I taken the newspapers that have been piling up in the bathroom and thrown them away? Some sort of uncluttering. And then instead of all my feelings coming up, my sponsor said, take I call it a reefer, because I used to like to smoke a lot of reefer. And my first R is for resentment. Do I have any resentments about you? I write them down. F is for fear. Do I have any fears? And they come up more than I would like to admit. So I write them down, get them out. And then the second R is resentments that I have against myself. You know, I haven't run the whole week. God damn it. You know, when am I going to get back to running? And then I share them. I take a fifth step. AEIOU. And then, you know, Richie said, you got to have a Y. And you got to have three G's. And I said, well, what's the why? And he said, the why is something outstanding that happened today. Something that is really, really good. Many times my 11-year-old girl come in bed with me and just tell me, Dad, give me a back rub. And I don't like to get out of bed in the morning, I told you. But, you know, that'll be my Yahoo. Sometimes I'll say, well, you know, nothing really happened that great. And then I'm reminded, well, are you abstinent today? You know, are you clean and sober today? You know, take that for granted on a daily basis. And we're all not supposed to be, you know. be abstinent. We're not supposed to. I mean, I think most of us die out there and we're supposed to be, what is it? If you're abstaining, you're supposed to be restless and discontent. That's my normal state without the 12 steps. So the why is my Yahoo, and three G's are three gratefuls. I'm grateful for this, I'm grateful for that. The other day I said I'm grateful for pending sleep because I was tired. And then I said I ran out of stuff to be grateful for, so I'm grateful for the word pending. So I could talk to you afterward, but that's what it is in a nutshell. And the prayer and meditation is my father and I were looking for answers long before we came to program, and we went to transcendental meditation in the late 60s. And it's something that I've kept doing, and it's nothing, no real spiritual secret. I kept the mantra, and I'll close my eyes, and many times I'll just take a 20-minute nap and wake up, and I'll feel refreshed in the morning and in the afternoon or in the evening. And I read those spiritual books, you know, those little ones that we collect. I have one by Dr. Paul now. It's not OA endorsed, and if you're interested, I'll give you the name of it. But he wrote a couple of terrific books that I like a lot. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Mary.
Hi, Mary.
I love what you shared about just now with the reaper, but also the first thing that really stuck with me is like hanging out on the beach all day because you didn't like to work with you. I wondered if you had ever gone to DA to look at the money stuff, or if not, like how exactly you got rid of that fear.
Right. My experience is, I'm fortunate, like I told you about my home group in the other program. It's very structured, and we've got a lot of stuff. And one of the things they have in that home group is something called finance class. And if you're in that group, there's a gentleman that takes those of us who are irresponsible with our finances and works the steps with us and gets us out of being irresponsible. And there are people that I sponsor that aren't in my home group, and I use the tenets of finance class because I'm still in it, and I'm teaching in that now. So, and so I just try to pass that on, my experience, what I've learned. But yeah, there is a solution for that for me, whether it be DA or whatever it is. For me, my experience is in my home group. Yes.
Hi, Michael. My name is Hank. I'm a grateful,
standing,
compulsive reader.
Hi, Hank.
I'm curious, and I'm not sure why I'm curious, but can you talk about the relationship between your son and your children from the second family? How, I don't know why I'm asking that. It's just something that...
It's a blessing. I came here, I guess, in my first sobriety. I used to take Sean, my son, to Alateen meetings here. And my ex-wife would be screaming and shouting. And I guess there was a seed planted in Sean from then. And then Sean has been to meetings with me and everything. And I guess he started to identify. And then when Christine came into my life, we were... weekend parents. We had joint custody of Sean, and I had him on the weekends, which is really nothing. I mean, when you're a full-time parent, having a kid on the weekends is a breeze, let me tell you. But and so Christine never tried to be a mom to Sean, and she always, I was just very blessed. And there was, I don't know, I mean, he's got an eighth and ninth step coming up. He may come to Christine or might have a lot of resentments. But Chris and I and Sean have been really, really close. And when we had our babies, he was there when Nicholas was born. He was at Santa Monica Hospital. And we've always included Sean. I have not been very good financial provider for Sean. Thank God his mom, you know, has that part taken care of. But I've always, you know, tried to be there and called him. I went through this phase, Hank, where I would think, you know, he hasn't called me in his teenage years. And, you know, I'm not going to call him. And my sponsor said, yes, you are. You're going to call him whether he calls you or not. And I've always been consistent with him. Last night we went to the Men's Stag movie together with a bunch of other program people and stuff. It's a great movie, by the way. I'll tell you about it afterwards. But we're real close, and he's close to his brother and his sisters, and it's just been a blessing. So, yes.
It's my mom, Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi, I just want to ask you, as a double winner, since I'm presuming just from your recovery, you know, the desire to overeat, the desire to drink, and drug, whatever, those have been removed. So when your character, if you feel like your character defects are up, how do you determine as a double winner which program you want to go to, or who you want to attract, or which fellowship? How do you do that?
I keep it simple. Of the meetings that I go to, I have commitments. So I know Wednesday night I'm going to be at my AA group, and Friday night I'm going to be at my AA men's stag, and Saturday morning I'm going to be at my OA. And I just get commitments at those meetings, and I check it out with my sponsors. And it's really that simple. The desire to compulsively overeat has not left me, thank you very much. And some days are better than others, which is why I take a fifth step with my food on a daily basis and include another human being and God in the equation. Thank you. Yes?
Hi. I was just wondering if you could talk about how your self-image has changed over the years. I'm struggling with the negative thoughts of self-image.
The daily inventory helps me a lot, really does. And this program, my OA sponsors, really, really, I love them a lot. And as I do my AA sponsor, but that daily inventory. There's a person in my other home group that says, I got to love myself. I don't give a damn about myself. I need to love you first. And it seems to be true. It seems to be, when I feel uneasy, and I saw Jenna tonight, and I talked to her, I mean, it was like a 180-degree turn, you know. And that part, I think, you know, that St. Francis, it's better to love than be loved. That when I put that into practice and I act on that, I'm okay. I had a resentment against a teacher, and I used the B word. You know, and I said, "That bitch." And my and I asked my sponsor for a mantra every day. Poor Terrell, you know. And he said, "Here's your mantra." He says, "Today there are no bitches in this world." And I thought, bastard. And, but you know what? 2 hours into teaching, that lady came in my room and said, "I want your. Can I borrow your TV?" And I went into her room and I set it up for her and stuff, and she looked so stressed, and I felt really compassionate towards her. I wasn't angry, and I go, ooh, this mantra stuff, you know, really, really helps. So that inventory on a daily basis and striving to help others when I least feel like doing it really, really helps. Because, you know, let's face it, I mean, we're fear-based. We come from a place of not liking ourselves very much. We're always thinking of ourselves, or I'm always thinking of myself. And when I talk to you, I mean, I feel great. Is that it, or is there time for one more? Someone else? Has it. Okay. Thanks for the question. I wrote it down in my big book because, you know, right now I probably forgot, but I really have it there in black and white. And it's basically just 3 meals a day and with nothing in between. And, you know, people say I have a snack if I need it. Well, I define a snack, I think it's after 4 or 5 hours if I've gone without a meal, I'm working or whatever's going on, then I'll allow myself a piece of fruit or some cheese or some trail mix or something like that. The main thing is that I report it to my sponsor. I'm honest about it. And I don't have somebody at the morning meeting said they don't have recreational sugar. So I don't eat cake and I don't eat ice cream. But I love that sugar-free yogurt, boy, on Friday nights. That's a treat for me. So that's what it is, basically. You know, and then, you know, lately, I don't know, it's because I'm getting older or something, my stomach feels big. And then Terrell says, well, ask God in the morning, and I don't do it consistently, for the willingness to be willing to eat less, you know. And it comes from a higher power, along with being honest for what I'm eating and the prayer. And also exercise helps. I haven't exercised this week yet. So, all right.